It is my pleasure on Monday, September 13th, to introduce Michael Marks, someone I have known for some time and always in wondrous ways with the wisdom and knowledge and humor and authenticity that he brings. Now I'll go to what he said I should share. Dr. Marks is a lifelong learner, both with an MBA and a PhD, and he is a fixture in the ICF ethics community. A fixture. We need fixtures. He has authored the book Ethics and Risk Management for Christian Coaches, and I was privileged to be able to review it. And I have to say, although I am not a Christian, it's an excellent book to learn about coaching. It's absolutely excellent, so I highly recommend it. Dr. Marks has served as the leader of the ICF Global Community of Practice on Ethics, the ICF Independent Review Board, and he leads the Ethics Code Review Team for the Ethical Interpretive Statements. And he humbly didn't put down the thing I love best, which is the water cooler. He preserved the intimacy of deep conversations on ethics in something he calls the water cooler. Some of you already have attended a few of these, and it's the highlight of my month. Welcome, Nahum, and hello, Iran.
Shalom, shalom. Shana tova. Happy New Year.
Currently, Dr. Marks's passion is training coaches in suicide prevention. And I will put in the chat the website for this. And then I have one thing to say. His topic today is something we all need to learn and hope we never have to use. The topic is coach readiness in suicide situations. Welcome, Michael, and thank you very much for sharing your wisdom and your time here.
Absolutely. And Terry and I have been cohorts, conspirators, and many activists in the ethics community, and it's one of the reasons I love working with ethics, because there are such dependable, deep people, and Dahlia is a regular fixture as well, and we encourage you to show up, and as she mentioned, the water cooler is a spontaneous attempt at going deep. I think we always achieve that. But it's an open microphone. Say what you want. Just kind of raise your hand and speak up here. If you have a comment, please jump in anywhere. The nature of this conversation is somewhat factual. And so I understand listening here, but perhaps ideas and popping up in your mind and you want to, you know, get it on the spot, please just jump right in there. And the worst that can happen is I'll say, you know what, we're going to talk about that in just a minute. So contrary to what I prefer to do, which is talk, I'm going to show you a PowerPoint. Mm-hmm. Can everyone see that? Helping people who are suicidal? Oh, I'm not sharing screen yet.
There we go.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, some people are nodding. Yes, you're seeing it. Yeah, okay, good. Then I will just advance right on here. So, suicide is higher than expected in the United States from 2014 until 16. You might say, 16, Michael, can't you do better than that? Well, no, can't. The most accurate information we have is 2 years or older. In a lot of places, they don't send it to federal sources until the end of the year. And the best we have at the moment is a little bit from last summer, because there was an interest in how it affected COVID, which we'll talk about in just a moment here. But you can see in the darker places that, you know, it was higher than expected. Very few places it was lower. And does that mean that suicide is on the uprise? Quantitatively, maybe. But as an academic, I also have to note that it's also possible that the reporting is getting better and that more instances are being reported, and that necessarily the weighted average is becoming any higher. But I wanted to give you a flavor here across the world. On the left side, again, this is going into 2017, on how it was all nicely going down with a slight uprise in the United States until 2017. And then, of course, during COVID, these changed drastically. I looked at each one of these individually, and Russia and South Korea and Japan in particular have seen a significant rise during COVID. But I also wanted to point out with this chart, the United States by race. You can see a higher rate of suicide with Native Americans. The white average is still very high, and Hispanic, Asians, and Blacks being relatively low. The lowest people group in the United States for suicide ideation and completion are young, in other words, defined as 18 to 25, Afro-American females. That group seems to be particularly resilient as we've been tracking these statistics over the last years. So just to go into the COVID picture here, in August, we were able to collect some information. We can see that ideation is significantly increased among young adults, and all ages also, about tripled. And the word ideation is thinking about suicide seriously, but not necessarily attempting. The actual tracking of attempts is difficult, because I know a sheriff, for example, here in Colorado, that will not report an attempt or a completion. And forgive me for these words, but this is the words that we use, attempt and completion. We try to stay away from the word commit suicide, because that has that sound of legality, of sin, or of committing a crime. But I know a sheriff who will not report an incident as suicidal attempt or completion unless there was a suicidal note. And we know that 90% of the time in the week before an attempt, there is some indication of a strong ideation, but not necessarily a note. So we have to work with these type of things. Any questions there before I go into what are the main factors that keep people from attempting suicide? Comments? Okay. Well, I am certified in the QPR Institute, which is Question, Persuade, Refer, which we'll talk about. And Dr. Paul Quinette has come up with, he says there's this wall of resistance, and I think this is where the coach particularly can come in, this wall of resistance that's keeping people from attempting a suicide. Good health, medical compliance, a sense of hope, a religious community where the religion itself says that suicide is not a good thing. Not to emphasize those religious practices that advocate that you're going to hell if you commit suicide. That particular religious belief is largely out across the board, although, you know, that stigma still remains. Availability of treatment, possibility of a safety agreement, also known as a non-suicide contract. Medical community uses that somewhat here. It doesn't decrease the likelihood of serious ideation, but it doesn't necessarily increase it either. Either way, the fragile person is like Humpty Dumpty sitting on the wall, and that if too much happens too quickly, then that might just push the person over. So I have a graphic here on how suicide increases over time. And on the x-axis, you have risk, and on the y-axis, you have time. And what happens is there's this period of contemplation where the person's maybe not even conscious of, you know, the fact that suicide is an option. But then, for whatever reason, ideation starts coming in, and that's when the coping mechanism of suicide becomes a little bit more part of their reality. And it is often held that, you know, if you say suicide to a person who's in the contemplative stage, you will push them over. That really doesn't actually happen, according to research. It's more that they remember, oh yeah, it's there, and that is one of my options here. And of course, if you were raised in a family where a close relative, a family member, had taken their life, then it's also part of your behavioral practice to, you know, look at these type of options, as opposed to somebody who was raised, you know, with absolutely no contact with suicide. And there seems to be a very strong difference there. But the critical part is when they start moving into implementation. That's where they start collecting means to take their lives. And that's when it moves into a much more serious level. Either way, this wall of resistance that I've been describing starts always, you know, becoming bigger and bigger, and they find more and more and more reasons. You know, we just held our e-summit last Friday. I'm still actually pretty tired from that. It was a 10-hour session here, and I was the host, and have really enjoyed it. You know, talking about, just an aside here, I don't like the back-end work for these type of conferences. You know, the emails and the constant checking, the technological things. But I'm so into this topic that this work that would normally drain me didn't drain me at all. I was getting excited. The more I would do more paperwork and back-end stuff, the more excited I got. And I think that's an interesting principle that I've learned about myself in the last couple of days, weeks really. I've been spending several weeks on this project. Anyway, coming back to the topic here, we have this wall of resistance. And what I was going to say is, in the event Dr. Matthew Sleeth, who was an emergency room department head for many years, pointed out that the likelihood that somebody wants to take their life is very, very small, and gave some very interesting studies that prove that people don't want to take their life. But the best way to describe that is what a nurse told me in the form of a question. She would always ask people that were suicidal, do you want to take your life, or do you want to stop the pain? And the answer is always the pain. And so, again, here too, it's a way to offer alternatives to the coping mechanism spectrum, I like that word, of the individual, so that they realize there are other possibilities. Now, let's just, let me pause there. Maybe someone wants to comment or question.
Michael, this is Nahum. What you are saying is that the bigger the risk, the higher or the more factors need to be evident or existent in the wall, right? In order to prevent.
Yes, there's a combination of things, and we'll talk about the signals, the red flags, balloons they're called here, these cries for help as they start multiplying against each other. where some of those things that I showed you in that wall, if they are shifted, like a connection to family, a connection to church, a loss of job, and the death of a pet, you know, suddenly multiply it against each other to bring this person to the point of wanting to make an attempt. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, Nachum, that addresses what you were asking. Dahlia?
Hi. I like the fact that you showed the factors that they prevent suicide, because most of the people would show the factors that make people suicide, and this made something, you know, something change in my mind. Well, look at what could prevent suicide, and this is probably things that we can coach about, but maybe it's too early to talk about it.
Well, certainly we'll come back to that topic, because that's the essence of what I want you to take away, are what you can do to keep the person alive long enough to heal. That's really the objective.
Okay.
And we're not therapists, but we can be therapeutic in an emergency situation to the point where the person wants to live at least another day, and then another day, and then another day, and 3 days, and they're probably good. Again, everything that I'm saying, especially when I put a number on the table, I do have research for. I'm an academic by heart. I'm not going to refer to each one of those because that would be very boring. But if you do want to know where any of these particular numbers come from, just let me know and I'll dig that out for you. Okay, moving on. So the person makes an attempt. And like I just said, there's about a 3-day window here when they might make another attempt within those 3 days. So to spell that out, I have a different chart here. You have that wall, and the likelihood of a repeat attempt in terms of hours is very high when it's about 7 hours. And I came up with these numbers. I made them all seven so that I can remember them easily. 7, 17, 37, and 77. In other words, in about 3 days, it is less likely that the person will attempt again. So when you're not the therapist, but you are the human who is in the middle of this situation here. And if you contact them, you know, within a couple of hours, and then maybe the next morning, and then maybe, you know, within a day and a half, and then 3 days, and basically four communications in that time frame, the likelihood that they'll go through is very minimal, especially on your behalf. A lot of times I get the question, I wish I could have done more. And I'm not saying four is a magic number or is the right way to approach this here, but, you know, it's about what the average person seems to need in order to feel cared for. And care is, there's two factors that make people want to stay alive more than anything else: care and hope. And hope is the more powerful one, but it's a little trickier because, you know, about 2/3 of the time, depression is involved, and 1/3, you know, it's clinically depressed, and another 1/3 is temporarily depressed or despondent, if you will. And if a person is depressed or highly depressed, and you add hope, well, one of the reasons why they're depressed is because they don't feel hope. And so if you try to emphasize hope, you're actually, you know, putting fuel on the fire, because they can't feel hope, and you say, well, be hopeful. So I'm always a little careful with hope. My daughter works with suicidal people in the Philippines, and she says care doesn't have as much as an impact as hope does. But in the Western culture, particularly in the United States, care seems to be the best thing that you can communicate, the best thing that you can do in 3 days. So,
can you define care?
Well, you know, just coming back to this slide here, staying in touch with them. How are you doing? Now, we'll talk about, you want to get them to a mental health professional as quickly as possible, but that doesn't mean that you should, you know, just say, okay, they're talking to a psychiatrist, they're talking to a therapist, I'm done, because they reached out to you initially. And for that reason, there is a bond that couldn't have happened with a stranger. And I particularly take it upon myself every time I do an intervention to try to you know, stay in touch with the person if appropriate. I'm also a emergency department volunteer. I go in when someone's suicidal. We basically stay with them in, you know, for 72 hours in one form or another. And some people have asked me, you know, I live in a ski area. Why do you care? And I said, well, I drove 45 minutes in a snowstorm to get here. I care because you are worth living. Your life has value, and I'm excited to see what value you're going to bring to the future. And because of that emergency department connection here, I'm not always privy, or I don't always want to, you know, stay in touch with that person. I'm not privy to their private information. You know, I do usually check on in with the hospital and see if there's any more intervention needed. So I think that over answers your question, which is what educators do, is we over answer questions on purpose to allow us opportunity to keep on talking, right? So let's just quickly look at this in terms of years. Now, there's very strong research that shows that an attempt that would be repeated is the strongest in 2 years. Any previous attempt makes a person 40 times more likely to try again, but the most critical factor is within 2 years. And some of the research says 18 months, but, you know, let's just err on 2 years. And, you know, when we talk to someone, one of the first things we do is ask them about their experience with suicide and how long ago that was that. And if it was less than 2 years, which I think is an easy number to remember, then we know that it is much, much more likely that they will go through with the attempt than if it had been long ago or never at all. Definitely there is a repetition on this. So the next thing I'd like to do is talk about some of those warning signs, those red flags. Any other comments here? Now, as we go through this, you know, when we first started setting up Coaching Suicide Awareness, our nonprofit, we fully expected that the people that would be coming to us for training would be those who have clients or have had clients that were suicidal coaches. Well, so what did we discover? What we discovered was the people that were coming to us were coaches, where their clients were coming to them for help. My aunt, my sister, my daughter, my grandchild is suicidal. What do I do? You are that trust person. And for whatever reason, they're reaching out to you as opposed to their mental health professional or, you know, the emergency department or their pastor, priest, rabbi, their, you know, best friend even sometimes. They're reaching out to you for information, you know, and this PowerPoint I'll make available to you. I'll send it to Terry if you like. Please use it. Please imitate it. Change it. Use it here. But my point was I gave this presentation on Zoom to a company in Ireland a couple years ago, And one of the guys got my power presentation and put it on his computer and just kind of forgot about it until one of his clients in California contacted him and said, my sister is in my house here and I think she's suicidal and what do I do? And he's like, I don't know. So the only thing he could remember was my PowerPoint, and he pulled that up and got on the phone with her and kind of quickly walked through some of these things that we're talking about here, and that saved the day, so to speak. It's that, and I've been there many times. Someone says, I'm suicidal, and your amygdala, flares up, and you almost go into limbic lock where you can't remember what's the best thing to do. All you can do is remember one alternative. And so, that's one of the points to what we're trying to do today, is get you prepared for that situation, because it's scary. It's not hard. It is relatively simple, but it is extremely scary because there's a lot at stake. And I could tell stories, but I do want to go here with some methods. So the warning signs. The upside intervention skills training called ASSIST, they call it balloons. People are like putting up little balloons and saying, pay attention to me. And these might be overt or covert. They might be, completely unknown to the person as a signal. But when they start, again, multiplying against each other, and here I give you the suicide prevention lifeline. You want to write this down, have it handy at all times, because that is the North American, in other words, Canadian, United States number, 1-800-273-TALK. And we'll come back to that in just a moment here. But these desires, if that's the right word, to kill themselves, to look for ways, buying a gun, researching suicide online, and maybe they say to you, oh, did you know that you'll take your life a lot faster if you slit your wrist this way as opposed to slicing your wrist that way? Isn't that interesting? Whoa, why are you talking about that? Why do you suddenly find that interesting? This feeling of hopelessness, no reason to live, like we talked about, an unbearable pain, either emotional or physical. Being a burden to other people, somebody that is incapacitated or has become suddenly incapacitated in physical or mental forms and feel that, they're just a burden to other people. So we see a sudden increase of alcohol or drugs. I've seen statistics for North American white men attempting suicide that drugs and alcohol are present in the blood 87% of the time with a serious suicide attempt. But here we're just talking about the consumption, being anxious or agitated, behaving recklessly, sleeping too much, too little, withdrawing, isolating themselves, rage, excessive mood swings, basically any significant change. And again, in isolation, they don't really mean that much, but multiplied together, they can mean a lot. For example, she had long hair, so she has short hair. She has short hair, now it's suddenly purple. He used to be a very sharp dresser, now he's a sloppy dresser, or the other way around. It doesn't really matter what sign you're talking about. It's the addition of these things compiling together that makes you ask yourself, Is something going on here? And these are just what we're seeing here. We're not talking about the situations, which we'll talk about next, the situational changes in their lives. But I wanted to tell you a story here at this point. One of my friends in Denver was working for a company where they had a high-level performer. She was one of the department heads, and her work just went way down over several months to the point where, they were discussing, letting her go because she was not performing. And she came to work on a Monday, all euphoric and happy, and everybody was like, hey, great to see you, you know, happy again and back to your old self, and this is wonderful. And one of the her colleagues, you know, got a little suspicious and took her to lunch and said, there's, you know, a significant amount of change going on here. What's behind all of this? Well, it came out in the conversation that she was suicidal. And the only reason why she hadn't taken her life up until that point was because of her two children. And over the weekend, she decided what she was going to do with the two children. The coming Friday, she would take her life and the life of her two children. Now, needless to say, the EAP, the Employee Assistance Program, was called. Those children never came back to the mother that day. You know, it took several weeks for them to be reunited. They were put into, you know, foster care. The employee herself was put into a type of rehab. And the good part of this story is that about 3 or 4 months later, she was back to work, and the department, the company as such, fully embraced her return. And without stigma and without, you know, oh no, is this a dangerous person here? They fully embraced her as she is, accepted her for what she had gone through and what she had learned, and she was back to her high-performing self in no time with the love and acceptance of a very progressive company, in my opinion. Mm-hmm.
Michael?
Yes.
I take Medscape News. And last week, there was a notice that the FDA had not reviewed the information that had been sent to them about medication to grow hair. I don't know if you've heard of it.
The answer is no.
Propecia or Propecia, it's finasteride, 1 milligram, and it carries with it the threat of suicide ideation. They've been warned about it. So There are medications that are dangerous for this reason. I'm sure that there are many others.
Yeah, I'm not a medical professional, and I'm really not even a clinical person. I'm an MBA. I do have a doctorate in adult education, so I know something about the human brain. But I have not heard of a drug where suicidal ideation is a side effect that depression is, and like I said, depression is often linked with suicide. You know,
one of the questions:
suicide cause depression? Does depression cause suicide? That's up for discussion here, but I don't know that a drug can actually do that. Your question?
Well, it seems to me among the questions that might be asked of someone who is depressed and sad and all is, what medications are you on?
Well, if you understand the answer.
Well, you know, one doesn't have to, but it's if you're reporting, you can certainly include that, those facts.
Reporting is an interesting topic here. Mandatory reporting among adults is only obligatory, if I'm not mistaken, in Virginia, New York, and Washington. Mandatory reporting for people under 18 is across the board. That's everywhere in North America. But for adults, we don't necessarily have a lot of mandatory reporting. And my team has been working really hard at trying to find this information, and we don't. But recently, we just found a way in which we're excited about learning how to ask. Who to ask. We found who to ask, but we had our e-summit to prepare for, so we kind of put that on the shelf for right now until next week or whatever. But, yeah, So what my premise here, Charlotte, is keeping them alive for 72 hours. So let's work on that. So the next thing I wanted to point out here are three
things. Can I ask you a question, Michael, please?
Sure.
This is Elaine. You said that the company was able to have the children put in foster care and the woman put into some kind of a program or rehab. Do companies have the legal ability to do that?
No. To make you know, unless you live in Singapore. Singapore, if you show signs of a suicidal ideation, they actually arrest you. So that the government is entitled to put you in a place where they think you belong. So no, we're talking about an employee assistance program, and I do know
a story.
I
asked that because
I was going to say I knew a story of an employee assistance program where this happened on a Friday. The vice president got involved, intervened. Tried to interfere with the work of the employee assistance program for a suicidal employee. Tried to stop it because she was afraid of the reputational damage that it was going to do to the company. And on Monday, she was fired.
Who was fired? The suicidal person or the...
The vice president who tried to intervene with the EAP program.
Okay, so the reason I ask that is because if people knew that, they may be much more circumspect about who they would share any of this with, about suicide.
Right.
If they knew that the company could do such a thing.
No, this is employee assistance programs are almost always on a volunteer basis, but they're individual. And the unfortunate thing is that I think less than 5% of companies over 100 employees have one. So.
Okay.
Okay, three things that are present. Now, the word here is critical. You know, this is like the next minutes. Maybe hours, but now. So there's intent, there's a plan, and there's a history of attempts in 2 years. So my team and I got together and we put together something that is, based on the QPR method. We have question, persuade, and refer. QPR, question, persuade, prefer. I encourage you, and I'll give you this resource here in a couple of minutes, the QPRInstitute.com for $29.95, and this is a commercial, a serious one. You can take their Gatekeeper course, and I'm entitled to give that course. I'm certified for it, and it's a great course for being able to learn what you do, what you say, and more or less how and when you say that. So you ask them questions, you persuade them to live and see a therapist and refer them to that therapist. And we'll talk in a minute on how to do that. We go to the 800 number. We make sure that the person is getting help, not abandoned. One of the ethical principles of coaching is that you never abandon a client. That doesn't mean you have to stay with them, but you need to make sure that they're, passed off into good hands. So, for example, actually taking them to the emergency department or working with them to make an appointment with the therapist would be appropriate in a critical situation. Check in with the person for future suicidal risk. So not just those 77 hours, but maybe in 7 months, or in a year from now. Just stay with them. We have 1-800-SUICIDE, which doesn't work very well, 1-800-784, which is not as good. This one is the main one, 1-800-273-8255. And drum roll, please, by June of next year in the United States, we will have a three-digit 988, similar to you pick up the phone and you dial 911. This is 988, and you will be able to get mental health immediate intervention service access. In parts of Colorado where I live, it's already in place. I've wanted to pick up the phone and dial it just to see if it works, but I, you know, don't want to. I can't ethically do that. So, I'm waiting for someone to tell me that they've actually heard that it works. So, landing the plane here, I want to give you our easy to remember, what we hope to be easy to remember way of assessing that the situation is critical. Now, critical means in the next minutes. For example, I'm eating lunch with my son, and the phone call rings, and it's my friend Patrick, and he says, "Michael, there's this a guy in my garage named Frank. He's got a gun, and he wants to use it. Will you talk to him?" And I always thought, "Huh, that's an interesting question. Will you talk to him? What would happen if closed-ended question if I said no?" So I get on the phone with Frank, and within about 15, 20 minutes, we get him to the point where he's ready to go seek help. And, I get a text from Patrick saying, "We're on our way to the emergency department. He's given me his pistol. I'll let you know what happens." And in the end, everything came out okay. But let me just tell you the interesting part about that story, though, in the middle. What was the tipping point in that particular conversation was his nephew. I was asking him several different questions, but one of the questions I asked was, "Who will miss you?" And this guy has a wife and adult children, and he's a strong member of the community and a really good job and all that type of things around him here. But I said, "Who will miss you?" He said, "Well, I guess my nephew." I said, "What about your nephew would cause him to miss you?" He said, "Well, we go fishing every summer for about a week. We don't catch much fish, but we have a good time together. And I think if I weren't around, he would really miss that." And that was the point that talked him off the ledge. That was the point that, began to have him focus on staying alive, and we could then move forward on that. So what I want to give you now is the acronym, Please Don't Die. If you saw the advertisement for our e-summit, it was the Don't Die e-summit as an acronym. That stands for Death, Intent, and Experience. And we'll go through each one of these here. But if these three things are coalescing, again, multiplying against each other, you may have critical failure and you might need to act a little bit more directly, more assertively, and make sure that the person gets to a helping spot very quickly. So let's take a look at these. Death. Are you thinking about suicide? Tell me about it. Have you been contemplating death? What do you mean you wish it were all over? Have you been considering killing yourself? Not a good question is, are you thinking of hurting yourself? People will say, "No, I never hurt myself. I just want to kill myself." Never really understood the logic there. But, you can say, are you suicidal? Or have you been having dark thoughts? Or it really doesn't matter. The important thing is that you ask the question. The question itself is not as important as that it's asked. And this is what I maintain about coaches. Coaches are great interventionists because we're powerful question askers and we listen attentively. And that's really all you need. The research is very conclusive is the longer you listen to a person, the less likely they are to attempt. I'll repeat that. The longer you listen, the less likely they are to attempt and complete. And what you say isn't as important as that you're there. Okay. So D, I, the intent. Do you have a plan now, or are you just toying for the idea that that time factor there that we talked about, lethality, do they have a gun? Are they planning on buying a gun? Hanging, poison, outside of North America, well, in developing countries, agricultural poison is the leading form of suicide. Among women, it's pills. Among men, it's usually guns. Women are... four times more likely to attempt suicide. Men are three times more likely to complete a suicide because they use more lethal means, more violent means. Paul Quinet calls suicide the most violent crime in the United States. And debatable whether the word crime is correct, but the word violent, I think, is very important. It's a violent act, whether it's done subtly or aggressively. It outpaces homicide 2-1 in any statistic at any point in time in our history. So how would you take your life? Again, these type of signals, I just want it to be over. The pain is too great. Not a good question is, you're not seriously thinking of hurting yourself, are you? It's like, you know, I really don't have time for this here, dude. So, you know, just go away. And if you're suicidal, just go talk to someone else. That doesn't help at all. I think we have a moral responsibility to stop, slow down, or shut down whatever we're doing and focus on this person here, because that's important, especially when the person is in this critical, you know, near time environment. So what is your experience? Again, here, 2 years is a key number. You know, if it happened 40 years ago when they were a teenager, that's still much more of a bigger influence than if they've never attempted or never suicide ideation before. Who would you talk to? Pastor, friends, prayer group, hospital rehab program, therapist. I was talking to somebody and she said, well, I guess I could reunite, you know, reconnect with my therapist. In the next 15 minutes, we talked about how she would do that. She actually did it herself. I followed up with her about 4 hours later to, you know, hold her accountable for that. And she had contacted her old therapist and they did have an appointment for, you know, the next couple of days. This who would miss you question, like I said, it's not only family, but it can also be a pet or your garden or, you know, people you work with, you know, who will miss you? Not a good question is, well, since you failed last time, what do you think will make you successful this time? I mean, that might be a good coaching question. Or I don't know if that's a good coaching question, but it's certainly not a good intervention question. So, again here, please don't die, death, intent, experience. Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about some other questions, then we're going to look at resources, and then I'm done. But does anyone have a comment here? Okay, and again, I'll share this presentation.
Thank you, Bob. Michael, I'm curious about how effective you have found to be coaching questions in adolescents and plain adults and old people. Do you have any data about it?
I have experience, Alfonso. You know, the good coaching question is an open question. How likely are you in the next days to take your life? Well, that's an open-ended question. Personally, when I'm trying to assess risk, you know, the criticalness of the situation, I go for yes or no questions. Are you thinking of taking your life? Yes. Have you thought about this in the last 2 years? Yes. Do you have a gun? Yes. Well, boom, we're in a different situation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, adults and teenagers, well, I just think coaching is the best thing in the world for parenting. Why not use the coach approach to talk to your teenagers than, you know, the typical parenting telling and directiveness here? I think we can get a lot more traction with our teenagers in any type of situation. But it would not be the first time that a parent has talked a suicidal teenager out of moving forward because they're seriously willing and able to listen. Willing and able to listen. You must be able to listen as a parent. And that's what makes coaches so powerful, is because we are able to listen.
Thank you.
Some other good questions. Who can you talk to? What have you asked God about this? In our presentation last week, 73% of people are trying to bring God into a suicidal decision. I think that's very interesting. I didn't know that before last Friday. Are you getting support from a mental health professional? What are you looking forward to? An upcoming event. It's often held that people are more suicidal during Christmas. That's actually not true. It goes down during Christmas time. Suicide ideation, because they're looking forward to being reunited with their relatives and having these connections that they had. Loneliness is one of the biggest drivers of suicidology. And if there's any time of the year that is where it spikes just a little bit, it's early spring, where they said, okay, I had a depressive winter and now it's spring and I'm still depressed. So it must not be the weather, it must be me. What is keeping you alive? Not a good question is, since you have no hope, what will give you hope? I mean, that's circular reasoning. So, you know. But I've heard people say that to suicidal people. Since you have no hope, what will give you hope? Okay. So some resources, what I mentioned before, the QPR Institute, qprinstitute.com, online $29 gatekeeper course, the suicide prevention, this suicide prevention services website, this one, Suicide Prevention Resource Center, that's where we're going to go to get the answer to mandatory reporting. We're going to talk to them in more detail. An international suicide place and a international crisis center. So as such, presentation, that's a picture of my book that Sarah Yee wanted me to mention. I'm so glad that she got to read an advanced copy and comment on it and give me some feedback before I published it. That was very helpful back then. But that was
2016.
I think we've known each other since 2014. Terry? Yeah.
Maybe even earlier.
So, yeah. Got a couple minutes. What do you think?
Who's counting?
Terry, I know, wants to talk about some administrative things, so I'm done. As such,
I will say my administrative thing and then the last few minutes questions. The administrative thing is that on November 8th is our next one, and Javier Sanchez, who is just about ready to graduate, he's already passed his final, is going to be doing Our Brains, Three Emotion Regulation Systems. Okay, that's it, November 8th. But here we are now, September 13th. If you have questions that you really would like answers to, feel free to email them to me and I will pass them on to Michael. Is that okay, Michael?
Absolutely.
Okay. Any one question now for
Michael? I want to thank you very much. You took off the lid of something which is very scary even to think and deal with, and now it's much more, I feel much more calm and soothed, and I know like the basic stuff to do, and thank you very much for that.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm. And it works.
You know,
I've had two situations in my 35-year career without any training, and thank God, bringing that in, I intuitively followed what Michael was saying and didn't know it was good, but it worked. So, Dahlia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Didn't Dahlia
make it really, really simple? Listen as long and as hard as you can.
I just want to thank you. It was a little bit heavy for me. It was very heavy to think about this topic. But really the questions and the way you brought it, it made it more familiar. Even though I am a former social worker and I had some experience, but well, the way you brought it, it was... And I wonder how as coaches, I agree about the questions and the listening, the powerful question and listening. But anyway, with ethics and with our responsibility, what about our responsibility? When do we know whether this one needs a psychiatrist, or we can help with our abilities?
Our premise is refer to the best possible professional as soon as possible. In the absence of that, maybe it's you. But it would be a unusual situation that the person lived in a community where there was no professional help. Mm-hmm. Whether there's quality professional help is another thing here. And I say in their community, because for some strange reason, people in need like this, they want to talk to someone local, even over the phone from 30 miles away, versus a highly trained professional 1,000 miles away. They would much prefer someone local. I don't understand really why, but it is that way. So you always want to, as a professional, and if you were a plumber or a lawyer, I would say the same thing. As a professional, you want to know what your local resources are.
Okay.
And be able to refer those quickly.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think I'm inspired beyond any coaching to listen carefully as a friend. It inspires my humanity for your presentation, that the more caring we can bring to any interaction, the better we are and the better the people receiving our caring are. Thank you for your presentation.
And that is the perfect conclusion. Michael obviously cares very, very much. He has put his work, soul, and time and passion into this topic to educate people like us. We're the ones that, for the most part, we're the ones in sun right now who are really connected with this topic. And Lisa asks, can we explore the Gatekeeper course? And if someone is willing to take the lead for that, I will definitely participate.
You can take it online, or I can give it to you on Zoom.
Oh.
I am a certified Gatekeeper instructor.
Okay. Good. Good, good. Thank you very much, Michael.
So we will get information about that in follow-up?
If you want the Gatekeeper training, I would, like I said, go.
I'd like to be able to share it with some Stephen ministers who run into this. Yeah.
So take a quick look at qprinstitute.com.